Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today I have a wonderful guest, Dr. Van Tran Nguyen. She is a multi-hyphenate in the real sense. You have accomplished a lot. Just the one movie alone, like when I watch the movie that you did, Motherlode, just watching that alone and kind of understanding all the positions that you play just in that film. And then when you look at the work on your own personal profile, your own bio, I'm just blown away. There's so much here to talk about, but I think we'll open it up with the Motherlode, the movie that you produced, so we can stretch things out and have a understanding of your ecosystem.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. That's what a wonderful and generous introduction. I wish I could bring you everywhere and have you introduce me like that. That's very lovely. Thank you. Thanks so much. Like as you said, I'm a filmmaker and I'm a scholar. I also teach at the University of Georgetown. And I made a movie called The Motherlode. And The Motherlode is a film that stars just my mother and I. And we revisit stories that are often told about the American war in Vietnam, just using our bodies to interrogate, you know, the source material, what it gets wrong, what it gets right. And the movie is a narrative film. So it's also kind of this fictional story about a mother and daughter trying to find each other and understand each other within all of the fiction of their own people's history.
And when audiences watch this film, will recognize the real amount of brain power that you have. I mean, you act in it in multiple roles. You wrote it, you co-directed it. I'm sure you produced it as well, of course. Those four things are in and of itself positions in the business of making a movie. It's mind-blowing that, I mean, the writing alone is, it's witty and it's refreshing. And as a Vietnamese person, for me, it really shows how much you understand the struggle of what diaspora kids go through. And then you understand really the lens of how America has watched Vietnamese people through the lens of war films. It's really intriguing to watch all this go down in your project in the Motherlode. How did you get started with the arts? I wonder, what was your upbringing?
Thanks for that question. I was born in Vietnam. I came here when I was five with my mom. And, you know, being like resourceful Vietnamese people, like immigrants, my family was pretty vehemently against the arts because it's, you know, this gigantic risk, so it seems. You know, I didn't grow up with artists at all. I didn't grow up with filmmakers. I just knew that I problem solved in a way that was creative, and probably I problem solved in a way that was like closer, if you analyzed it, closer to how artists problem solve than maybe someone that is like more perhaps like, you know, analytical or methodical. And so I just knew that this is a language that or like my personal language of how I kind of see the world. And I couldn't really resist it. I went to school for, I have an undergraduate degree in biology because I was lying to my family and everyone that I would, you know, eventually get into medicine, which is, you know, every kind of immigrant parent's dream. But I would go to those classes and walk in through the doors and just felt like everyone had a secret code that I didn't know because I didn't really belong there. And so I took a ton of art classes, and I took enough art classes for, I think, an advisor to be like, do you think you want to do this? And it hadn't dawned on me that it was even a possibility. And so I didn't tell them that I was doing it. I didn't tell my family. And it just felt like I like don't feel understood in any other capacity than this. Like, this is the place where I feel like I'm fully understood and I can be myself. So yeah, I took enough art classes that I ended up getting like an art dual degree. I had a professor offer me kind of like a studio assistant position. And that's how I started to work towards like my MFA, because he was the head of our MFA program at the time. And he said, I think this is like, you have a shot at this. And then it was there in my MFA that I met another artist, Kathy High, who, you know, she's like, I think that this is something that you can continue on. And I ended up getting my PhD in electronic arts and media. So, you know, it was the right like mentorship and the right folks that really saw me as I was, that I got to become the person that I've always wanted to be, right? I was like shepherded by other folks that I think, you know, saw themselves in me as well.
Your mom plays a huge role, literally and probably figuratively, in your life and in the motherlode. And when you get a degree in biology and the expectation is to go to medical school or follow a healthcare profession, I'm looking at the movie and watching it, thinking the whole time, I'm like, wonder how much did mom have an effect on you? Because it seems like she was taking direction and going along with your plan. And I have so many questions when it comes to your relationship with your mother, because on the one hand, it seems that she's like playing along with you and it's a fun time for her. But the other side of it is, I'm wondering how much she understands what you're writing for her to say as well.
Yeah.
And how much in it, quote unquote, in it, is she in on the joke or the all of the sort of the things that you lay out?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, she is, we kind of wrote it with her in mind. So the movie started off with, well, one, I was writing my dissertation and thinking about like, you know, like Vietnamese media and how like the diasporic Vietnamese people were, you know, like thinking, looking at Paris by Night, like how it is that they wanted to assert themselves, right, in American media and so I like started to kind of look at a lot of this. Like a lot of like movies that were like Vietnam War movies or movies that were purportedly about Vietnam. And I realized really quickly that, you know, the Vietnam War movie itself is a genre, but you can't name as many famous Vietnamese actors as you can these movies. So, you know, all of this kind of points towards the fact that like these movies are looking to like rehab kind of a perspective of, you know, like this like failed war, like for Americans. It's trying to like kind of rehab this like, you know, like American failure. And like Vietnamese people just happened to be a byproduct of it, right? Like it seems like the diaspora in these movies is like an accident. And
or
so
as a stand-in
or a stand-in precisely, right? Like, or, you know, like literally scenery, like, you know, in like Kathy Lynch's movie, like we were the scenery, that's her family story. And watching these movies, I couldn't help but notice that. And obviously my lived experience as like a Vietnamese person growing up in like Western New York, where it's not diverse at all, I couldn't help to also reflect on that type of isolation. So, you know, the interesting thing about my mom and I is that we're extremely close. And we, like a way in which she like learns English is that we watch movies together with the subtitles on. And so one of the movies that we watched, you know, in 2020 during the pandemic together was, Spike Lee's Defy Bloods, which is like his kind of hat tossed into the ring of like the war movie. And it's so interesting because I have a lot of respect for him as a filmmaker. And yet I watched this movie and I felt like he fell into the same trappings of like very specific ways in which, you know, like a lot of directors get to talk about Vietnamese people as some type of prop, as some type of problem, right? Like the polemic. And so, I watched it with her and I made a lot of assumptions about how it is that I would like to be seen or we would like to be seen. And it's really interesting because she's like, well, I don't know that I exactly feel that way. Or there's like some things that we just get so wrong. And in that conversation, I realized that there's a lot that like is not said between families, even so much so that we like, if I were to now, you know, write my own story, I don't know that I could do her story justice. And so like there was where this kind of conversation began. And both my husband and I, you know, it kind of like interviewed her and talked to her for a really long time about like, you know, these errors, what these movies get wrong, what they get right, what she sees in them, because she does go out of her way to watch them as well. So we wrote this like script for her. And we wrote this script in both English and Vietnamese. So it's like a truly bilingual story. So I wrote it all in English. I had it translated in Vietnamese for her to read and for her to approve of, right? Because I didn't want her to say anything that wasn't, that is disingenuous to her experience. And I didn't want any of the critiques to feel like it fell short of like what she wanted to say. And so, yeah, she was in on the storytelling aspect of it. And like also the thing that I kind of, wanted to like highlight is that, you know, there are a lot of aspects of this movie that is like critical and biting, but it's also deeply funny because like when we watch these movies together, it, you know, she is kind of joyful because she gets to see Vietnam, which is like a huge deal, right? Like Vietnam, you know, updated or Vietnam, however one perceives it to be, right? So for her, it's kind of a bit like of an exciting adventure too. But yeah, she was in on the story. She got to read the scripts. She got to change the dialogue. So it felt like kind of her like vernacular and the way that she talked and the pacing. Yeah. So she was pretty involved in the making of it. Right. So like, hence the mother load.
Mm-hmm. It's a very complex script.
Yeah.
It doesn't follow traditional storytelling, Hollywood storytelling. You know, I watched it and I said, this deserves to be watched a few more times because it's almost like watching you as a professor tell us some ideas and teach us, point out things that most of us don't understand. And I think I wanted to find out from you, when you set out to make a film like this, that's not like, it's not traditional linear storytelling, how do you come up with this way of telling the story and know that it's the right form and know that it is going to work? That was the biggest thing. When I watched it, I was like, mechanically, how did she know that this is going to work? Because it's kind of like, I mean, it could be a stage play too. You know, you could do a two-person, you and your mom can take this show on the road for sure, easily. And I think it would work.
Yeah, it was a risk. It's not like a kind of like traditional five act structure by any means. I just felt like it wasn't, because this was like my debut feature, I just felt like it wasn't worth it to kind of play into whatever genres or, you know, like in satirizing movies like the Vietnam War movie, which are very specific genres that follow a very specific three or five act structure. I knew that in order to kind of critique it and make it my own, I couldn't exactly fall into any of those trappings. And so, yes, it was like a gigantic risk to play every single role and to have my mom also play, you know, 30 roles as well. I had a feeling that if I wanted to really like poke holes at this story, I was going to have to do it in a way that was like deeply like creative or innovative. I wasn't going to use the same language if I'm going to like hold them accountable, right? Like it was like the thing where I kept the text or the scripts. I also reenact for those who haven't watched it yet. My mom and I reenact shot for shot some scenes from famous Vietnam War movies like Apocalypse Now, Platoon, et cetera. So, and we do it all on like a stage in a high school, right? So it kind of looks like a high school play because the point of like these movies is that Vietnam is a character and that it could be anywhere, right? Like, so for example, you know, like Stanley Kubrick's film was shot in like London and England, right? And it was supposed to be Vietnam. And so, you know, the point is that these are all fake stages because it's not a way to talk about Vietnam. It's a way to kind of like ostracize or make Vietnam like the perpetual other. You know, in this particular case, we wanted to be really like playful and creative about these reenactments because we're also kind of like tongue in cheek satirizing it. Because in a way, like the way in which Vietnamese people are represented in these movies is a satire of Vietnamese people, right? It's a satire of like, you know, like famously, Francis Ford Coppola talks about his film Apocalypse Now. He says, you know, my film isn't about Vietnam. It is Vietnam. So that when you watch that interview, you think to yourself, what an insane person, you know, like how could you possibly think that? And so therefore to kind of reenact some of the absurdity of these like, you know, celebrated directors and what they think about their movies. We kind of thought about, you know, making it as cheeky as possible. What if this was like all a high school play? And what if like, you know, kind of, you had to revisit some of these scripts that were written and celebrated, but two Vietnamese women say it, right? And my mom's Vietnamese, like accented Vietnamese language or English language, like how uncomfortable would it feel if you heard that? And how uncomfortable it must feel to be a Vietnamese person that feels even more other, right, than she usually does watching these movies. Like that's what these movies do, especially for me. And that's like kind of the thesis statement is that it continues to render the other. It makes Vietnamese people even more foreign, you know, as a diasporic people.
When you recreate these scenes in these big war films, and then you have these directors and you're playing all of the roles. You think about how truly absurd the thinking is, but that's just level one. Because when you think about level two, level three is those guys and their vision are affecting the entire United States. Yeah. And it affects the general public and then it affects the military and then it affects the leaders that are making decisions for Afghanistan, for Syria, for Palestine. It is doing all of that dirty work. And my question is, do we think that these directors actually know how they're affecting the water downstream? Do they know that they're polluting it upstream? Or do they just think that they're auteurs and they're just giving their vision to the world?
I think that's a great question. And that's the question that I have, right? That's the question that carried the movie. Is there such thing as an anti-war film? It's impossible. It's impossible to make an anti-war film because in making a war film, you are recreating and resurrecting these tableaus that are beautiful about the like apocalyptic tragedy of one's life, right? Of a nation's life. And it renders this, it like puts this nation on ice, right? Like when you say like, okay, so there's this really awful like word association game. When you say Vietnam, people in America immediately think the war, right? There's like no kind of other memory. There's no other public memory that has replaced this like really apocalyptic event for our people. And so obviously making stories about it, there's consequences. And whether or not I think these filmmakers know what they're doing consequentially is, I think that's like a question of intent. And as like an artist, it's complicated. Sometimes I feel like, you know, intention matters and sometimes I don't know. But you know, for someone like, you know, so say someone like Francis Ford Coppola who says, you know, this movie isn't about Vietnam, it is Vietnam. I think that, I think he knows exactly what he's doing. I do, because I think it's really oversimplifying it to like not recognize critically like the power that these men have over like our nation's like shared memory and history. You know, like I think it's really I don't know. I think it's really irresponsible. And that's like the other kind of criticism that I have. And at points the movie skewers this, them is like, you know, kind of saying that there's like this gigantic responsibility that was taken extremely lightly, which I think goes to show, you know, and obviously it has this trickle down effect. It goes to show of how we treat immigrants, how we treat refugees. I think it is of a piece.
It's all the product of these films.
As a young
person, it has a lot to do with the root causes of this.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. As a young person, I walking down the street in Western New York, I heard people scream, you know, out their car window, "Me love you long time," to me, not ever having, known the Stanley Kubrick movie that they're quoting. And so the memory of a lot of, maybe I would say like generations before us, the memory of a lot of like Vietnamese people are in these movies, right? So like they saw the "Me love you long time" scene before they saw an actual Vietnamese person in real life, right? So I think being like culture makers and, you know, like filmmakers who are very powerful, I think that there are like real consequences to the work that is already done, right? Like there's a little bit of like damage that we inherit as like immigrants when we come into like a country or refugees. And therefore, I think that there should be a little more care. I mean, a lot more care invested in ways in which, you know, like war is taught or told. And even in schools, I was never taught about the American war in Vietnam, right? Like in the textbooks, there is, you know, like two or three pages, and the first image that I see in a textbook is of like the My Lai massacre, which is like, you know, children that have died. And that's the first vision of Vietnamese people that I see kind of officially, like, you know, like in my educational journey. So therefore, I think that, yeah, they hold a lot of consequences. They hold a lot of weight, these stories.
I exist in the middle ground, in the purgatory of balance. And the reason I live there is because I don't want to divide the diasporic sort of, there's so many generations, there's so many different viewpoints about Vietnam within our Vietnamese diaspora. And I think that, I say it's the purgatory of you know, moderate politics, because I do believe that we should be able to make jokes about things, right?
Yeah.
I don't know where to draw the line sometimes in my mind. And I think I do this work sometimes so I can see who's chiseling out the kind of the correct borders that I can play in. But I can never get the correct answer, because on one end, I do believe that guys like Hung Cao, the new acting Secretary of the Navy, should not be making jokes like what he did about the Ku Klux Klan, about, you know, making slits and giving him a hood. But at the same time, I do believe in our First Amendment rights to say whatever we want. And so I live in this strange place all the time, and I'm trying to make sense of it all. Where do you stand with all this?
Well, I think it's incredibly fair for you to be like really like measured about it, and I think it's really complicated, right? Like, I'm really disappointed in like the kind of bootstrap mentalities of someone like Hung Cao, right? Like, and in that, like, if you can't beat them, join them kind of mentality of, you know, someone that belongs to a diaspora that would be, you know, in his party, they'd be happy to kind of erase our people's history. I think it's incredibly disappointing. Like that type of, model minority perspective is, I think, incredibly limiting and painful to see, because it's, to me, someone that is really like removed from their own history. And I think that for me, when I see something like that, it's a symptom of white supremacy doing its work. The fact that like he has like kind of like an erasure of like the resourcefulness of what it means to be like an immigrant, and the fact that like immigrants are actually suffering at the hands of, you know, the party that he believes in is to me really, really painful, right? Like it's like a bit of a betrayal. And the other thing is that I think it's really, like on the one hand, you know, like for the movie and the stories that I tell, I'm really cautious of, you know, using very specifically like I terms, right? Like I believe this, my family believed this, like we grew up believing these things to be true. But the kind of really beautiful thing about like how diverse and large the diaspora is that many, many folks have different ways of becoming an American, right? Or getting here. And different folks kind of have different allegiances and different stories. And therefore that's the reason why I think I made a Motherlode is like, I'm throwing my hat into the ring. I'm welcoming of other perspectives and I hope that there are more, right? So that I'm not the only person that's like out here alone, like making these like, you know, strident like comments or perspectives. So that's the thing that I like hope for is that, you know, I welcome any other kind of like perspectives or commentary on this existence, because I think it's really, as you said, quite complicated. But like, you know, saying this kind of, you know, more like, you know, like left leaning or you know, I actually think that the like the statement of the movie is kind of like, well, if we're really interested or like constantly if Asian American media and cinema is really interested in thinking about representation, why don't we kind of go back into the histories of how we were represented and reenact the very like, you know, stories that do us harm or erase our people's story.
Yeah. It's an active act. And I always wonder, are people who are making these things really aware that they're doing this? Or is it just ha 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 ha, tongue in cheek, this is funny to us and it's innocent to them? Because there's a difference between a diabolical, you know, I'm part of the Third Reich, I'm doing propaganda films for the SS, right? You know, it's different when you're like in the ranks and you're like, I'm purposely making movies that highlight the supremacy of white people. But it's a different thing when you make something where you think it's ha 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 funny, but it really creates the erasure of other people. And you know, it's so funny, I make these video clips about political figures or political ideas, and some people are like, there's no way you're a Marine. Mm-hmm. Or they'll make, you know, and I'm like, no, I come from that mm-hmm. Republican world where I made fun mm-hmm. of myself and being a zipperhead, mm-hmm. being a gook, mm-hmm. loved me long time. Every kind of joke that I can make about myself to make myself blend in and to make other people laugh, I did it.
Yes.
And I think to myself, at the time, I had no idea what I was doing. I just wanted to get the reaction. And that's how I see some of the films that are made. Not that they're humorous or they're comical, but the directors had the idea of just, you know, hey, this is the Vietnam that we experience and might not be Vietnam to Vietnamese people, but, and it's kind of innocent and hollow all at the same time, but it's not diabolical as a filmmaker who is, like I said, part of 1940s Germany, right?
Yeah.
What's her name? Lenny?
It's Lenny Riefenstahl. Yeah, you don't have to be Lenny Riefenstahl. Yes.
Yeah, Riefenstahl. Exactly. Couldn't get that last name. That's always like very tiptoeing, you know, around that name.
Yeah, the thing is that, I mean, it's, you know, she romanticizes it. She romanticizes the Third Reich, right? Like it's like it's viewed, like it's like robust and beautiful. It's something that you study in like film, like in film school. And it's obviously a tool of propaganda. And it's, while, you know, while propaganda is like really extreme, like example of that type of filmmaking, I'm really interested in the nuances of like where it slips, right? So I'm not really looking to like the thing that I think is more interesting is not when a filmmaker is, you know, quote unquote, being diabolical or so intentional about their perspective. It's when it kind of accidentally happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's within those accidents and it's within those like small conversations that people reveal themselves to, right? Like if you look at a movie that I think is a really great perpetrator of this is Good Morning Vietnam, right? And in the film, I call it Good Morning Vietnam or When the War Was Fun. Because I mean, it's Robin Williams' movie. He carries it. It's a funny movie and he's the star of it and he skewers everybody. Seemingly. But if you kind of start to like look at punch for punch, the story is, you know, he befriends a young Vietnamese man who ends up being a Viet Cong. And his sister is kind of this like gorgeous honey trap that he falls in love with, right? So, you know, in the fact that like everyone kind of gets skewered. You start to think about, well, what's the kind of the other side of that, right? Like, even like his officials that get skewered, you know, the like kind of stiff upper lip guy, he gets to go home and have his power. The kind of like sister or his love interest, she doesn't really have access to that. And his best friend who ends up being a Viet Cong, who like, you know, blows up a cafe in his own neighborhood, which is strange. He again doesn't really have access to the same story, to the same ending as everybody else.
Mm.
So when you kind of look at that and like the slippages of like those like types of nuances,
yes.
you kind of can't help, but I'm like, oh, this is how you perceive us, or this is how you perceive Vietnamese people to be, right? You're basically saying, oh, don't get close, they'll trick you. And so the reading between the lines is something that I think is much more interesting, albeit not diabolical, right? And it still is like, you know, like funny and perhaps irreverent. I'm really interested in the ways in which like these like really big like fanfare stories are like, don't look over here. We still have our very specific biases and you will always be different. But don't look over here. We're still trying to make you laugh. So that's the thing that I find like really, really interesting. And of course, like our existence is really complicated. The movie itself is, you know, a comedy. Because I find, interestingly enough, like this diasporic reality, even in its grief, it's really kind of deeply, like absurdly hilarious. You know, like I think it's like closer to absurdity than it is anything else. Like this, you know, like my diasporic reality.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan. The sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows. The feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at H Mart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
When I think about our reality as Vietnamese Americans, first generation, 1.5 like you, you consider yourself 1.5?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Second generation like me, I think about the Indian population of Britain during the colonial period that they experienced. And there's got to be writing from thinkers like you in those periods, right? There's got to be. I don't know. I just think about these things. And if there's writers that are writing during those periods about the same way you're looking and you're critiquing whatever, there's probably no movies at the time, but plays or whatever, or newspaper. There's got to be these thinkers that wrote about it. But how is it hundreds of years later, we are still experiencing the same dynamics between our colonial masters and the othered? How are we still, it's 2026 and this stuff is still here. It has not disappeared. It's gotten even worse, maybe, arguably, I think.
Yeah. Well, you said it. It's white supremacy. It's working overtime. It's working overtime, right? If the work of white supremacy is to erase people, to disappear people, to disappear stories, it's working overtime, and it's like deeply embedded in everything that it is that we do, right? Like, I mean, you know, the 1618 Project is like to think about the like origin of like a making of America to be deeply embedded in slavery and racism. A project that I'm working on right now, a book that I'm working on with my collaborator, Natalie Fleming, we look at statements like Nation of Immigrant, right? And how often the word Nation of Immigrant has been weaponized to be this kind of like false empathy. Because what it does is that erases the actual origin of the nation, which is the indigenous and the indigeneity that persists and flourishes and is thriving and surviving, right? All at the same time. And so when you say that you're a nation of immigrants, what it does is it kind of like its undertone is a white supremacist undertone as well. It's to kind of like talk about these other forms of like migration to kind of make them okay, where it's completely erasing the actual origin of said nation, which is it's built on the genocide of indigenous people. And so, you know, and constantly doing that type of stuff, again, performing these other things, right? These flashy performances of empathy culturally, it loses sight of its actual like origin, right? Which is, like the genocide of like many indigenous populations that have lived here before and continue to live and strive and take back their land.
I want to address two other things that have nothing to do with what we're talking about. It's from the mother load. And I'm like, it's in the back of my mind, and I'm just like, oh, I want to stay on this topic, but then time is so limited sometimes. Because not only do I want to talk about these two things, but there's other things that I want to talk about after that. So the first thing, there's two things. Saigon Ai, which is the soundtrack I keep hearing recur in the film. The composer is Ivan, and his daughter's granddaughter's Quaha. They made the Ivan documentary. And I kept thinking about the music rights and how complicated that's been for Vietnamese people in America that use the soundtracks of this period, the beautiful period, and it's really been a hot mess with the company that has been trying to like steal the copyright of Ivan and a lot of different I don't know what the intricacies are, but so I kept thinking about the dynamics of that that song and how it kept playing. And the meaning of it as it relates to the Vietnamese diaspora around the world. The thing that's related to that, and then we could start with the thing that's related to, is God, the most creative thing that I saw in your film. I mean, there's a lot of creative things, but this was the most, I don't know how you arrived at it, but I had to talk about it. The scooter that you built from the parts in that room, and your mother's on it, and then it plays Saigon Ai, and it's facing me out. I want to cry thinking about that scene. And somebody like me can remember when we were little kids hearing Saigon Ai playing at, there's this restaurant in L.A. called Tan Vi, and it was like a shack in L.A. in the 80s. I was a little kid, and we went to that restaurant, and I remember the rain would come down, and Saigon Ai would come on, and there were glass that looked out to the street. And I remember thinking how many people in here wished that they were still in Vietnam. And, you know, it brought so much memory of what I thought Vietnamese people fantasize about their homeland and their home, and watching that scene that you put together really rocked me to my core. Like, it really moved me when I watched that. Oh, how did it come about?
Thank you. Thank you for, that's like, yeah, such a, I'm really happy you brought it up. It's like one of, it, I think it is a, like you said, it's like a shared memory. You know, like, so my, like, similarly, like a memory that I have about that song, and the reason why we hear that song for the first time while that kind of like melancholic scene is happening is because it's exactly that, right? It's a song that is like, it's strangely like it sounds joyous, but if you listen to it as a diasporic person, it's very melancholic and kind of, if anything, like there's a lot of grief there. And there's a lot of grief in terms of ownership, right? Fighting for its rights, or like to keep the rights of the music, and how it's used. And, you know, I remember working on my short, Erie County Smile, trying to get a right for a Carole Kim song. And it was also like, I think we fought pretty hard to get it, but it was like owned by perhaps RCA or something like that. And so, you know, in the like Saigon Oi song, in that part of the movie, I thought a lot about my kind of early memories of listening to that song. And I thought about kind of the first, you know, my first memory of being in Vietnam when I was like maybe 4 years old. And it was like during the Lunar New Year. I mean, one of my earliest memories of that song was I was, you know, 4 years old on a scooter in Vietnam. And in Vietnam, the scooters, the kids ride in the front, you know, between his parents' legs. And I remember that it was like raining and it was like during Tet, which is the Lunar New Year. And so I had a poncho over me, right? So I was like tented and I can kind of smell the sweat of like, you know, my mom who was riding the scooter and like the hot rain falling onto my legs. And that song is playing, you know, because it's that it plays like everywhere, right? Like people are playing it in their storefronts. It's just, or it's like, it's also like kind of like made into like 8-bit and played from like, you know, stuffed animals or whatever. And so for me, it was like this early memory of Vietnam and like the comfort and the warmth, but a little bit of nostalgia. Like I said, the lyrics are kind of like, if you read them, it's kind of really, there's a lot of like forlorn. It's like a little sad, a little grief. And so that's the reason why we chose that song is that, you know, she remembers Vietnam and she has this like memory. And so she has to kind of cobble together, which I think is really, I mean, it's common in my family, but I think it's common to like kind of cobble together bits bits and bobs of like, you know, one's American life to kind of remember, or to kind of reflect, deal with, the memory of home. You know, it's kind of like how we cook when we cook like Vietnamese food, right? Like the ingredients aren't Vietnamese anymore because they were here. But the point is like with these ingredients that aren't inherently Vietnamese, we're making this Vietnamese meal and we're making these like very specific memories together. And so that's why we chose that song. I think it's a song that like for like a lot of like diasporic Vietnamese people at me, it kind of conjures like a lot of like, you know, memories of like of grief, of forlorn, of joy, because it's usually played during a celebration. So it's really complicated. And I think therefore that song represents a ton. It holds a lot, right? For like, you know, for our memory.
Yeah, what a beautiful scene. I mean, that is so creative. One of the most memorable parts of that film that made me question how far the power of creativity can go in inside of an art, the mind of an artist. Because, you know, you're acting, you're writing, you're producing, directing, the whole thing. But then this shows up as a very specific production design issue or scene or product. And the result of it is moving. And when you think about it, just as a consumer like me or an audience person, it just gets right to the core, you know, of all these memories, of all this taste and smell of a restaurant when I was a kid, and remembering when that came on in this restaurant, the rain would come down, and just brought back this nostalgia for me, wondering what went on in the adults' minds about how they felt about being away from home at that time, maybe 8 years, 9 years away from home. I mean, it's like so close, and you know, they'd only left for 7 or 8 years, and they had to like deal with this trauma of losing their entire lives.
Yeah. You know, it's like it's kind of funny because how I described like another sense memory that I think perhaps we can share is or perhaps we share is like of our parents like wailing, singing these like songs in karaoke. Right. Like I grew up in a lot of like basements, like with a hot pot or like whatever meal on the ground, the steam. Yep. And like beers and men and like holding each other, like wailing these like very kind of emotional songs. And to me, it's like I get them. I'm like, oh, they understand emo music. Like this is their, you know, they are like, you know, wailing to like, you know, this is their like us holding each other and like, you know, singing like My Chemical Romance or something. Right. Like, and it's just like, it's a release. It's like ways in which we work through like conflict or friction. And it's like, it's a deeply emotional thing. It's like, there's like so much like feeling and affect there. You know, and a lot of, and the other thing that I think is really interesting, speaking of like kind of the politics and rights to music, it's a lot of this music that we hear or don't hear has been, or like hear, listen to here, it like has been, like, you know, for a while during like Vietnam's like reconstruction era, it was like censored. So it was not music that you could actually like have access to so easily. Because, you know, it was like considered like bad for the country's morale, right? Like building a kind of a new attitude or a new reputation. So like this type of music that's like forlorn and deeply sad, it has been kind of like been limited in a lot of my parents and their like, you know, their young life in Vietnam. So I think it's this like really great kind of like reprieve, but it's also like really kind of forlorn. She feels a lot of grief, but it's like potential because it's right before, you know, before you get to kind of take a sigh of relief and we go back to Vietnam and we see modern day Vietnam.
You are a professor at Georgetown, which is no small, like that's not a small deal. That's like a really big deal to me at least. But to the bigger picture here, it's a big deal. And when I think about Viet Thanh Nguyen, and I knew him when he was a first year at USC, and I don't remember him being so loud and vocal, but if I could remember back, his thing was English. You know, he's an English department guy, and you know, he's a young professor. When I look at you, you are a young professor at a big university. And the world, like you said, the white supremacy is working overtime. Your work is about to get even more loud, or probably needs to be more loud, probably from your perspective. And you're dealing with a few things, I think, working in an institution like Georgetown in D.C.
Yeah.
It's complicated because how I think about these universities is, well, they need to be funded and they need to have money coming in from donors and you know, federal backing. It's complicated, it's tricky, but the breeding ground for intellectuals and people who are thinking about these issues, it's a petri dish of growth of these ideas, of insurrection, of revolutions, of, you know, the students come from students that begin revolutions and protests come from universities. How are you navigating and mitigating all of the landmines that are potentially showing up in your way in the next decade? Do you think about this? Have you contemplated like how far you can go, and because you still need to work, but
yes. Of course.
It's complicated.
Of course. Of course. I think about it. I think about the history of higher ed all the time. You know, I think, I live and work, so I live in Baltimore, but I work in DC, and I do that by design because the work that I get to do in Baltimore, and like how I, show up for my community, how I show up for, you know, artists and creative folks in Baltimore that I'm deeply involved in, informs how I interact with students. It involves, or the way in which I'm involved in my community, it hopefully is reflective in like my pedagogy. Working in DC is really complicated. It's really, really complicated because the thing about like Georgetown students is that they come to DC and study in DC, right, to eventually like have a career and future there. And so I feel like it's my utmost responsibility to think about, or rather reflect upon the like revolutionary histories that take place there, right? The protests, like, you know, we talk about our like your First Amendment, like your right, your right to not like concede to the things that are being told to you, right? Your right to critique and your right to be outspoken about it is one that I value and one that I impart to my students. And you know, like I said, I'm a young professor, but I also, you know, before becoming a professor, I did a lot of work in terms of like independent media and you know, a lot of my work and research has been built on folks that are protesters, are folks that dissent. Those are my mentors. I look up to them. Like a lot of whom are, women of color, scholars of color. You know, like these Black and brown women that have gone out of their way to like nurture and care for me. You know, that type of mentorship is the type of mentorship that I impart onto my students. Because our embodied presence, is also like an act of rebellion, right? The fact that I'm there, that I talk to my students, that I teach my students, about these rebellious histories is incredibly important. Because if they go on to be really powerful people, I would like for them to know the scale of power as it pertains to the people.
That's a great answer. You know, sounds like you've thought about it, and there is a trajectory of change, and we need more Vietnamese people to really think of progress, because I think sometimes the majority of us are aligned with white proximity for the wrong reasons. Yes. And the future of these older January 6th types with the old flag, you know, it's a sad state of affairs because it's just not understanding what the political context is. You know, it's pure ignorance. But how do we fight against that and pull this off with success and not entirely cut off our connections to the people we love the most, which is our family? And you know, and I am the biggest culprit of saying this, like, oh, you know, we don't want to be divided, we want to be united, but then I don't talk to most of my family anymore as a result of our politics that, you know, we don't fight about, but we just know deep down inside, you know, what this is about. We just can't sit in the same room anymore.
Yeah,
we're worn down.
It's incredibly painful, right? Like, I think that's what you're saying, Kenneth, and I think it's like incredibly painful to like have relatives that that you were raised by, that like, you know, you make memories with, and a lot of like beautiful memories and even complicated memories, like that you don't see life the same way. And I know that there's like different types of grief, and you're kind of also talking about like this generational grief in a way. I am not, the thing that I'm not interested in is throwing people out. Like, that's not it, right? It's like, we kind of, if you have the energy and the capacity calling people in and standing firm in what you believe in and not like conceding to having to share this perspective in order to to make sure that these people that like the people that you love, their needs are met, right? It's like something that I think is really complicated and really hard to do. You know, so like for a while I was a court translator, and I would like show up in the court and help, you know, whoever needed Vietnamese to English translation. And like when it comes to like how we show up for each other and how we need each other, I don't need you to agree that, like white supremacy is alive and well for me to know that it is hurting both you and I if you do not understand how our legal system works, because it's not translated in your language. So there's ways in which we show up for each other that I think is incredibly meaningful, that has almost nothing to do, like with your own personal beliefs, because the fact of the matter is the fabric of America is here and it's happy to diminish you. And I am here as a person that knows it, and I'm here to like help in any way for you to resist these potholes, whether or not you like believe in me or not.
That's so such a great way to put it. The system is happy to diminish your cultural, it erases you. But the funny thing is, those Vietnamese people are also happy to diminish their own cultural light as well. So that's the tricky thing. The hard part, I think, my brother and I talk about this quite often, is how do we have conversations, meaningful conversations, with our relatives and our friends who are on the other side without making them feel that we're condescending, that we are armed with elite institutional knowledge coming from colleges? There's this sort of resentment. It's the culture of resentment that it goes unspoken. Especially with the older crowd, when they're like, oh, you think you know everything, you think you've done it. Yeah. And it becomes this sort of like back and forth, and it's just, there's no winning this anymore, you know?
Yeah.
That's the tough part about this.
It's really hard. It's really hard. And, you know, I'll be the first to say, I don't know everything. I'm relieved when I'm wrong. Like, oh, thank God I'm wrong. Or, you know, something like that, right? Like that, like I'm always hoping to see that there's a meeting point, which, you know, I think as an educator, that's one of the things that you can learn to help make your experience less painful. The other thing that I think is really, really painful and difficult is that for a lot of us, right? Like I'm thinking about like younger generations who are queer, who are non-binary, who like live a life that is maybe outside of the imagination of that of their elders, who don't exactly have elders or ancestors to talk about this very like personal, very intimate experience with. It's incredibly painful. So I understand that like maybe resisting and not talking to your family is maybe the best thing that you could possibly do for yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, regardless of whatever your cultural identity is, that's, you know, like being isolated is no one wants to do that. And so, you know, I think it's really, I think what is important is like figuring out on a case by case basis what matters to you, right? Does it matter that you're correct? Or does it matter that you are trying to make, you know, memories with your family that is like outside of, you know, talking about politics or something like that, right? Because I'm quite similar. I have family members that I do not talk to because we do not share a perspective that I think is like pretty neutral, right? Like all people deserve to exist. I think that's like a pretty neutral exist, like a neutral stance. And so like, if, you know, we don't see eye to eye on that, I have a really hard time kind of trying to, you know, make new memories with you. Because it's really painful. And so I'm all for doing exactly what you need to do to survive, because I'm assuming the same of them. I'm also assuming that they're doing exactly what they need to do to survive. And survival is a complicated thing in this place, in this time.
How can our audience watch your film, Motherload? The Motherload.
The Motherload. Okay, so The Motherload is getting distribution. It will be available for video on demand rental on Apple TV Plus, on on Apple TV Plus and on Amazon Prime Video starting June 16th. And then a month later, it will be available on streaming platforms like Roku and Tubi. But yes, we are, we're given nationwide distribution. So you can find us on Apple TV Plus and on Amazon Prime. So please, please, please rent and watch the movie. If you're in Baltimore on June 14th, to celebrate our distribution, we're going to be having a free Baltimore screening at the Maryland Parkway Theater at 2 p.m. So if you're here, we'll be there doing a screening and a Q&A to follow. It starts at 2 p.m. And it also, the Q&A is going to be hosted by our dear friend James Willie of Movie Good, Movie Bad. He's a film critic and brilliant. But yes, that's where the movie will be rentable and then streamed.
Thank you so much for today. I do hope that we can get back on the podcast after you finish your next work, your next book. And I think that I have so much hope after talking today about how we frame our culture as it relates to the new way of being here in America. It's an interesting time. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Very, very gracious to you and your time. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.